This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 31st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the nominee to head the Pentagon, Chuck Hagel, faces questions from a Senate panel. Some critics take aim at his record on nuclear nonproliferation. Lawmakers, labor leaders, and veterans call for protections for Social Security and benefits in the face of the debt ceiling debate. More Nigerian troops prepare to join an African-led force in Mali as the French military reaches key northern cities. And we'll go to California, where prisons remain overcrowded as the state faces a deadline to reduce the number of those incarcerated. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In a strike unconfirmed by Israel, fighter jets bombed alleged military targets in Syria on Wednesday. Today, Syria's allies are speaking out against Israel, and some international observers worry this could trigger an expansion of the conflict in Syria. FSRN's Jackson Allers has more from Lebanon.
Israel has remained silent on Wednesday's airstrikes, but unnamed U.S. officials confirmed the attack to media sources. Questions persist regarding Israel's intended target. Lebanese sources said the airstrike targeted a convoy carrying anti-aircraft weapons bound for Lebanon and likely the powerful Shiite resistance group Hezbollah, while Syrian reports today suggested that the airstrike hit a military research center in the suburbs of the capital Damascus, far from the Lebanese border as initial reports had suggested. Syria's allies have soundly condemned the bombing, with angry statements coming from Tehran and Moscow today. Also on Wednesday, Israel moved a battery of its new rocket defense system, the Iron Dome, to its northern border. Security sources said it's a preemptive move to defend against any rocket fire from Lebanon or Syria. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
The UN Human Rights Council said today continued Israeli settlement activity in Palestinian territories violates a multitude of human rights and constitutes war crimes. Chair of the Human Rights Mission, Christine Shani, said Israel should cease all settlement activity without preconditions.
It's prohibited because it's an obstacle to the exercise of the right to self-determination. If you look at the map, you will see how the settlements are breaking the continuity of Palestinian land. It's a kind of creeping annexation.
Report authors say it's up to the International Criminal Court whether to take up the case. In related news, the Israeli Supreme Court heard two petitions today that could have severe consequences for 200 Palestinians living in an impoverished farming village in the southern West Bank area. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has the story from Jerusalem.
Many questions remained after people slowly trickled out of the courtroom Thursday afternoon. Far-right-wing Israeli group Regavim filed the first petition, demanding the Israeli authorities stop delaying the demolition of 50 homes and other structures in the village. Regavim alleged the Palestinians were building illegally. The second petition, filed by Susia residents and the Israeli group Rabbis for Human Rights, asked that villagers be allowed to reach a large swath of farmland they are currently barred from accessing. The court ordered the state to assess the illegal building allegation. It, however, deferred its final rulings on the petitions. Arik Asherman is a rabbi with the human rights group.
I came out with cautious optimism. The court pushed the state rather assertively, asking, why is it that these cases drag on and on and on, and you haven't provided any relief or answers to people that have been waiting years and are suffering serious economic damage because they can't, you're not even processing their claims about getting to their land.
Susia is located in Area C of the West Bank, which is under full Israeli military control. Israel built the settlement, also named Susia, on a hilltop facing Palestinian Susia in the 1980s. Since that time, Israel has confiscated large areas of land from the Palestinian villagers for use by its settlers. The Supreme Court is expected to release a verdict on the petitions next Sunday. Jillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
A Chinese court today found two Tibetans guilty of inciting
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 31st, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the nominee to head the Pentagon, Chuck Hagel, faces questions from a Senate panel. Some critics take aim at his record on nuclear nonproliferation. Lawmakers, labor leaders, and veterans call for protections for Social Security and benefits in the face of the debt ceiling debate. More Nigerian troops prepare to join an African-led force in Mali as the French military reaches key northern cities. And we'll go to California, where prisons remain overcrowded as the state faces a deadline to reduce the number of those incarcerated. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. In a strike unconfirmed by Israel, fighter jets bombed alleged military targets in Syria on Wednesday. Today, Syria's allies are speaking out against Israel, and some international observers worry this could trigger an expansion of the conflict in Syria. FSRN's Jackson Allers has more from Lebanon.
Israel has remained silent on Wednesday's airstrikes, but unnamed U.S. officials confirmed the attack to media sources. Questions persist regarding Israel's intended target. Lebanese sources said the airstrike targeted a convoy carrying anti-aircraft weapons bound for Lebanon and likely the powerful Shiite resistance group Hezbollah, while Syrian reports today suggested that the airstrike hit a military research center in the suburbs of the capital Damascus, far from the Lebanese border as initial reports had suggested. Syria's allies have soundly condemned the bombing, with angry statements coming from Tehran and Moscow today. Also on Wednesday, Israel moved a battery of its new rocket defense system, the Iron Dome, to its northern border. Security sources said it's a preemptive move to defend against any rocket fire from Lebanon or Syria. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut.
The UN Human Rights Council said today continued Israeli settlement activity in Palestinian territories violates a multitude of human rights and constitutes war crimes. Chair of the Human Rights Mission, Christine Shani, said Israel should cease all settlement activity without preconditions.
It's prohibited because it's an obstacle to the exercise of the right to self-determination. If you look at the map, you will see how the settlements are breaking the continuity of Palestinian land. It's a kind of creeping annexation.
Report authors say it's up to the International Criminal Court whether to take up the case. In related news, the Israeli Supreme Court heard two petitions today that could have severe consequences for 200 Palestinians living in an impoverished farming village in the southern West Bank area. FSRN's Jillian Kessler-Damore has the story from Jerusalem.
Many questions remained after people slowly trickled out of the courtroom Thursday afternoon. Far-right-wing Israeli group Regavim filed the first petition, demanding the Israeli authorities stop delaying the demolition of 50 homes and other structures in the village. Regavim alleged the Palestinians were building illegally. The second petition, filed by Susia residents and the Israeli group Rabbis for Human Rights, asked that villagers be allowed to reach a large swath of farmland they are currently barred from accessing. The court ordered the state to assess the illegal building allegation. It, however, deferred its final rulings on the petitions. Arik Asherman is a rabbi with the human rights group.
I came out with cautious optimism. The court pushed the state assertively, asking, why is it that that these cases drag on and on and on, and you haven't provided any relief or answers to people that have been waiting years and are suffering serious economic damage because they can't, you're not even processing their claims about getting to their land.
Susia is located in Area C of the West Bank, which is under full Israeli military control. Israel built the settlement, also named Susia, on a hilltop facing Palestinian Susia in the 1980s. Since that time, Israel has confiscated large areas of land from the Palestinian villagers for use by its settlers. The Supreme Court is expected to release a verdict on the petitions next Sunday. Jillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
A Chinese court today found two Tibetans guilty of inciting self-immolations, according to state media. Over the past 3 years, nearly 100 people, young and old, have lit themselves on fire to protest China's treatment of Tibet. The convicted men were charged with murder and one given a suspended death sentence. China has been scrambling to halt the high-profile protests. Six other convictions have also been reported. A New York joint legislative hearing on health and Medicaid yesterday turned into an indictment of how the state is handling an assessment of the effects of hydraulic fracturing on public health. Activists crowded the hearing, calling for more transparency in the process. FSRN's Jim Crivo reports.
Hundreds of people attended the hearing, including many who came to express reservations about the fracking health assessment review by the Department of Health that's currently underway. Biologist Sandra Steingraber says the public has been excluded from the process.
Now it's the review is being reviewed by the Department of Health, also secretively, with the help of three outside reviewers who are very esteemed colleagues in public health, but they also have gag orders and non-disclosure agreements in their contract. They were paid for only 25 hours worth of work. We want the public to be involved in scoping the study. We want public comments. We want public hearings. And we certainly want more than a 25-hour review.
A draft of the Department of Environmental Protection report was leaked to the New York Times earlier this month, reportedly clearing the natural gas industry to move ahead as long as certain precautions are taken to protect the public health. New York has not allowed the drilling process, but this may change sometime in February. Jim Crivo, FSRN, Albany.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama's nominee to lead the Pentagon, Chuck Hagel, answered questions from senators today about his support for Israel, his position on Iran's nuclear energy program, and his opposition to the escalation of the Iraq War. Hagel, a former Republican senator from Nebraska, would be the first enlisted combat veteran to be Secretary of Defense. During the hearing, Oklahoma's James Inhofe and other Republican senators challenged Hagel on his involvement with Global Zero, a group of world leaders who call for the elimination of all nuclear weapons.
We know that the president has said many times he wants a nuclear-free world, and I know that Senator Hagel is right there with him. But at a time when North Korea's belligerent actions threaten our allies with their nuclear capabilities and security of our own nation and that of our allies, why would we want to unilaterally disarm ourselves of nuclear capability?
Inhofe promised to vote against Hagel's confirmation, but Hagel said the senator misrepresented his position on nuclear proliferation.
My position has never been unilateral disarmament, ever, never. We have, over the years, which I have supported, the United States has led in reducing the efforts to reducing nuclear warheads. But in a dangerous world, nuclear arsenals and our containment policy, which I mentioned in my statement, has been critically important. We're not going to unilaterally disarm. Verifiable. It has to be bilateral. It has to be negotiated, as all our treaties have been.
Hagel also promised senators he would support the decisions to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell and integrate women into combat positions, and he would focus on improving mental health and decreasing sexual assault in the military if confirmed. The Senate is expected to vote on Hagel's nomination in the coming weeks. The U.S. Senate approved a bill today to temporarily suspend the debt ceiling, pushing the so-called fiscal cliff until mid-May. The measure already passed the House, and President Obama has said he will sign it. But progressive lawmakers and activists warn the move puts crucial social programs at risk when the bill expires, and others are attempting to avoid this scenario with legislation to abolish the debt ceiling altogether. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
During Thursday's debate, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle hammered the importance of avoiding default, which would happen if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling. But several Republican senators tried to tack amendments onto the bill that would force deep cuts in government spending every time federal borrowing goes up.
If we're going to raise the debt limit, we must at least show the taxpayers, the credit rating agencies, the world, that we're serious about getting our fiscal house in order.
That's Louisiana Republican David Vitter. Several of his fellow Republicans, including Utah's Orrin Hatch and Indiana's Dan Coats, argued that social programs should be particular targets for these spending cuts. Hatch said the Senate shouldn't wait until the bill expires in May to start making these cuts.
Entitlement reform cannot wait.
Hatch called on his colleagues to support an amendment that would require any future increases in the debt limit to be paired with dollar-for-dollar cuts to government spending. That measure was voted down, but progressive lawmakers, labor leaders, and veterans groups warn of future attempts to make those cuts. In a press conference on Capitol Hill Thursday, Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders said federal benefits for the poor, elderly, and people with disabilities are too meager already, and called the suggestion of further cuts obscene.
So we are here today to tell the White House and the leadership in Congress, do not balance the budget on the backs of the most vulnerable people in this country.
One of Sanders' main concerns is the proposal for a chained consumer price index, or CPI for short, which would make federal benefits increase less each year, even as the cost of living and basic goods goes up. President Obama agreed to a chained CPI during the last failed round of fiscal negotiations in December, and several lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have voiced support for the measure. But Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse told reporters Thursday that the measure would hurt many retired people in his state who already struggle on fixed incomes.
The things that they actually spend money on, fuel for transportation and for their homes, food to live on, the pharmaceuticals that keep them healthy, those are the dominant expenditures, and they all went up. So in their real lives, they had to pinch pennies even harder.
Yet as some lawmakers on the political left assert their priorities for debt ceiling negotiations, others want to abolish the debt ceiling altogether. Virginia House Democrat Jim Moran is co-sponsoring a bill that would do just that.
The debt limit is an unnecessary legislative hurdle that has proven to be both an ineffective means of controlling deficits and a danger to this country's standing in the world financial markets.
Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke and many other economists also support abolishing the debt ceiling, but the bill is not expected to pass the Republican-controlled House. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
The French government says it has reached a turning point in its military intervention in Mali after advancing to the northern city of Kidal, the last stronghold of Islamist militants. The French military said it will continue to target sites near the border with Algeria, according to AFP, but plans to transfer the military campaign to African-led forces soon. The UN-approved African-led international support mission to Mali includes troops from Senegal, Niger, and Nigeria, which has pledged the largest contingent. The Nigerian army says its troop deployment will also help cripple local Islamists who are receiving training and financial support from the militants in Mali. FSRN's Samuel Okoya reports from Lagos.
Just before they boarded the plane to Mali, a group of Nigerian soldiers engaged in physical exercises. One of them, Adamu Ahmed, says they will be up to the task when they get to Mali.
Well, I'm feel happy that I'm going to the peacekeeping in Mali. All the situation on the ground will know how to solve it.
The government also expresses optimism about the mission. Chief of Army Staff, Lieutenant General Azubike Ihejirika, says intervention in Mali will guarantee security because the Islamists in Mali have links with those in Nigeria.
All along, Mali has provided bases for the training of terrorists that operate in Nigeria. So it's a welcome development that the international community has come together to root out this problem. So whatever is achieved here will complement the efforts being undertaken locally here.
Nigerian Islamists say they will fight back. They already carried out a deadly attack on a convoy of Nigerian troops bound for Mali, killing 2 soldiers and injuring 5. The local Islamist group Ansaru, which claimed responsibility for the attack, said it was aimed at stopping Nigeria from joining Western forces interfering in Mali. Boko Haram, the largest Islamist group in Nigeria, has carried out a series of attacks since Nigeria sent troops to Mali. But it is unclear if the attacks have to do with the intervention in Mali. Tunde Akoni of Lagos State University says Nigeria should expect Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist attacks because the Islamists in Mali are affiliated to Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups have been attacking interests around the world. Nigeria is not an isolated community, so to say. So it would be foolhardy for Nigeria to feel that in the face of what's been happening in Kenya, what's been happening in Mali, we can claim to have a sense of security.
Following the outbreak of the French-led war and Nigerian troop deployments to Mali, Western countries like the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and Germany warned their citizens against traveling to Nigeria. The country already experiences regular violence, with more than 3,000 people killed in the last 3 years as a result of terrorist attacks linked to Boko Haram. Many people like Joy Agbonifo fear security agents will have problems coping with the extra burden of maintaining security if the Islamists heighten their attacks in response to Nigeria's troop deployment to Mali.
If the Islamists can kill soldiers from Nigeria preparing to go to Mali, that means ordinary Nigerians are not safe at all.
Nigeria's leaders said they are sending 1,200 troops to the United Nations mandated West African Force in Mali. President Goodluck Jonathan said the country will provide more than $30 million for the deployment and support of these troops, with some of that money going to humanitarian aid. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
Today, the military judge at Guantanamo Bay overseeing the hearing of five detainees accused in the September 11th terrorist attacks directly addressed a blackout of the proceedings earlier this week and ordered the government to discontinue any ability of third parties to suspend broadcast of the commission. On Monday, audio and video of the proceedings were cut for 3 minutes when a defense attorney began talking about the secret CIA black sites where defendants were held and allegedly tortured. The hearing this week involves charges against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the highest profile detainees at Guantanamo. The U.S.-run prison currently holds about 166 detainees, more than half of which have been cleared for release. The federal office charged with overseeing the transfer of detainees from Guantanamo to other countries is closing, according to the State Department. The announcement comes as a federal appeals court in the D.C. Circuit ruled that military commissions may not be used to try defendants for charges such as material support of terrorism or conspiracy, putting into question the future of proceedings of Guantanamo detainees. For a look at these developments, we're joined by Shana Kadidal, lecturer at the University of Michigan Law School and senior managing attorney at Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to FSRN.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
The State Department announced the closing of Ambassador Daniel Freed's office. He was responsible for finding a place for detainees who had been cleared for release but could not return to their home countries. There are also two other groups of detainees left at Gitmo. One is detainees that the government does want to bring charges against, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others fit that category, and more on that in a moment. But the other group is the more than half who are at Gitmo who have been cleared for release but are still being held, a majority of whom are Yemenis. What's holding them there?
Right. I mean, you correctly identify it as primarily a Yemeni problem, but still there are, you know, 86 men who are cleared, and only 56 of them are from Yemen. So there's still 30 who presumably, you know, a good deal of them could go home, although, again, some of them are, you know, from countries where there are human rights risks if they're sent back. But the biggest problem is not that the men themselves are seen as, you know, too dangerous to release. Obviously, they're cleared. The problem is not that they're viewed as dangerous people by the government, but that Yemen is viewed as a dangerous country, right? And anytime the U.S. sends anybody home, even if they're fully cleared for release, it wants the receiving country to guarantee that for instance, the former detainees will be monitored. They'll be subject to surveillance. Their passports will be pulled so that they can't travel internationally. They'll have to report into a police station or something like that every few weeks. You know, we want these countries to be able to keep tabs on people.
Well, how many proven cases or evidence is there for former detainees at Guantanamo engaging in military action against the U.S.?
You know, hardly any. There's one case of someone who was released to Kuwait who apparently developed mental difficulties while he was at Guantanamo and may have blown himself up in northern Iraq, killing a number of Iraqi soldiers. And there are a small handful of other cases that I would categorize as falling into the kind of confirmed category. But we've never seen any list of names. We've never seen any list of comprehensive allegations. Every time what we do get a name through some back channel and investigate it, it turns out to evaporate into thin air.
Shaina Kadidal with the Center for Constitutional Rights. There's also this ruling by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals that overturned the conviction of Ali Hamza al-Balul, who went through the military commissions. He was only one of two who was convicted through the tribunals. Now, this means that the military tribunals have not secured a conviction through the trial procedure. What does this mean for future cases?
So what it means is basically putting aside the 9/11 cases and the coal bombing cases, which maybe have some charges that are look more like traditional law of war crimes. Pretty much every other case out of those 30 some odd cases where people are going to be charged is going to be tossed out. The military commission prosecutors themselves have said that they don't think these are viable charges anymore.
Well, the other option after that would seem to bring those cases to the civilian courts. And what are the obstacles for that happening in the near future?
No, hardly any other than politics, although there is, I suppose, a fourth container that you can put detainees into, and that's that they'll simply be held indefinitely without any charge for as long as the administration wants to do that. Essentially, the continuation of the Guantanamo system as it, existed from the very beginning, a place to hide people away from any form of judicial process.
Shaina Kadidal is a senior managing attorney with the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The state of California is fighting a court-imposed deadline to reduce overcrowding in its prisons, which the U.S. Supreme Court said amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. Nearly 133,000 adults are currently incarcerated in 33 state prisons, down from 160,000 7 years ago. But some prisons remain overcrowded, and some experts say that it will take changes at the sentencing level and dedicated funding for alternatives to incarceration to break the state's long-standing reliance on imprisonment. From Oakland, FSRN's Pucklow reports.
It's been more than a year and a half since the U.S. Supreme Court mandated that California shrink its prison population by a fifth and improve its prison healthcare system in order to end needless suffering and death. The state responded to the ruling by implementing what's called realignment, or sending low-level offenders to prosecution at the county jail level instead.
So now if somebody is sentenced to a non-serious nonviolent crime at the county level, they aren't going to be sent to state prison. So they'll be either sent to county jail or put onto some type of community supervision program at the county level.
That's Emily Harris from Californians United for a Responsible Budget, or CURB. She says the effects of realignment are mixed. On one hand, there are about 30,000 fewer people in the state prisons. But the prisons are still over capacity and need to reduce the population by 20,000 additional people to meet court orders. Healthcare is improving inside the prison system, but it's still not up to constitutional standards, Harris said.
Yes, things have changed in California, but they still have a long way to go.
The state also authorized more than $350 million to be shared over a one-year period amongst local judges, district attorneys, sheriffs, probation officers, and rehabilitation service providers. But there are 58 counties in California, and with no rules on how to use realignment funds, Harris says the money isn't making it to community-based services. UC Berkeley law professor Barry Crisberg says it's the first time in 40 years he's seen a criminal justice program implemented without any oversight.
The governor and the legislature, by design, created no accountability. So there is a body that meets and, I guess, talks, but has no authority either to monitor and assess the spending of the money or, in fact, evaluate how the counties are, what kind of programs they're using.
Under realignment, counties have flexibility to create alternatives to incarceration. That could range from home detention using GPS bracelets to addiction treatment programs and community service. But the ACLU's Alan Hopper found that at least 32 counties plan to use realignment funds or other tax dollars to expand jail capacity.
Realignment is certainly a step in the right direction, but it didn't address at all this underlying question of the length of people's sentences for low-level nonviolent offenses. And until we tackle that problem and approach it with an open mind, and until our political leaders are willing to stand up to law enforcement, who lobby against these changes, we're not going to solve the overcrowding problem. And in fact, we're simply going to replicate it at the county level.
Realignment also hasn't helped reduce overcrowding at all state prisons. At Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, the prison's capacity was 187% last week. But Dana Simas, spokesperson for California's Department of Corrections, said that facility is not overcrowded.
The population reduction order was meant for us to get to a level where the court felt we could provide adequate health care to inmates. Well, with the improvements that we've made and the hiring that we've done in our medical and our mental health and dental units, we feel that with those improvements, along with the population reduction that we've had, we can meet that constitutional level of health care at the capacity that we're operating now.
At a recent rally in Chowchilla, hundreds of former prisoners, family members, and activists gathered to demand that the state improve conditions and fund alternatives to incarceration. They said that medical care inside the prisons was still far from adequate. At a recent rally in Chowchilla, hundreds of former prisoners, family members, and activists gathered to demand that the state improve conditions and fund alternatives to incarceration. They said that medical care inside the prisons was still far from adequate.
The people that have medical problems there, a lot of them are just neglected. They have cancer or, you know, something serious, and they don't get their med.
Chris, who only goes by one name, spoke to a cheering crowd outside the women's prison.
And I mean, you have those nurses or you have those doctors that look out for you, but then you have them ones that come on the next shift and then you don't receive what you need.
After serving 12 years for stealing a car and illegally carrying a gun, Chris was released in May. Advocates want the state to release some 4,500 women the department had initially said would qualify for an early release program back in September 2011. Although the corrections department says they can't move any faster and still maintain public safety, policy analyst Chris Berg disagrees.
The Department of Corrections has created all kinds of innovative barriers to actually moving women into these programs. For example, they were excluding women who had restraining orders out, which seems to me makes no sense that we're penalizing somebody who's a victim. They were excluding women who had health problems. There's, again, a series of rules they've made up that bear no relationship to sort of good correctional policy.
In early January, California Governor Jerry Brown asked federal judges to lift the population ban on state prisons. On Tuesday, federal judges granted a 6-month extension, giving the state until December 31st to bring its prison population down. But Governor Brown and California's Department of Corrections want the state to lift the cap permanently, a request that experts say is unlikely to be granted. Puck Lowe, FSRN, Oakland.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Carla West. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Special thanks to our Washington, D.C. intern, James Helmsworth. We thank him for all his hard work and wish him the best in the future. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.